What was your first instrument?
First instrument was alto saxophone.
And were you pushed to play that as a kid, or how did you come up with that? How did you come up with that? How did you come around that?
It was a bit of a surreptitious decision. I just for some reason I wanted to play alto. I don't know. I don't remember really why. Maybe Dad was trying to push in a way to, you know, I played a horn. I think he maybe wanted me to be a horn player. I don't know.
How old were you?
I was 11 when I first picked up alto.
And what was the first music that you consciously listened to around you, enjoyed when you were a kid, maybe? Was it records, or was it?
Yeah, Dad loved smooth jazz.
Wow.
Yeah, he you know, I'm from Houston, and he, Houston just had this thing where it had a lot of smooth jazz people coming through. It's like a very corporate culture, you know. And, you know, he had been through a lot of metamorphosis of taste. He really came from a garage rock band background. He actually had a band in the 60s called the Zachary Thacks, and it's like this British rock invasion band, and they actually did really well in Texas until the band dissolved. It like
what instruments was he playing?
He was mainly a bass player, but he also played trumpet and drums. He started on trumpet, and then he played bass because the band that he was in, he was playing drums at first, and then he got something happened where he's from Corpus, and he had to go to Houston for a year or two. And then the band that he was in, they got a new drummer. And then when he came back, they were like, well, we got a drummer, but if you could... He's like, well, I can play bass. And he's like, well, you don't play bass. And he's like, well, just give me like a month or two, you know, and he just fucking learned bass. And he played bass for professionally for 25 years after that, you know.
He's just a musician. So how do you think his musicality influenced you?
I think there is a certain thing where we were understood to be, he understood himself to come from like a musical family. Like my grandmother was one of my first introductions to jazz. She was one of the founders of the Texas Jazz Festival.
Oh, okay.
In Corpus.
Okay, everything's starting to make more sense.
Yeah, she loved Stan Getz, and she loved, she had Cannibal. When she passed, I got her record collection, and she had tons of Sarah Vaughan, tons of Stan Getz, tons of Ella, tons of ton of Cannibal Adderley stuff, you know. And then she had some stuff that just really surprised me. She had this Alfonso Johnson record. I'm like, all right, you know. She's kind of hip, you know. She had a couple of other things like that, maybe even a Weather Report record, all the stuff. But she was really an avid lover of music, and her, she was a vocalist, but she was a court stenographer by trade, and so she wrote in shorthand, and she. At first married my grandfather, who I'd never met, and he was a trumpet player, and his name was, everybody called him Shocky. I think his real name, I think he went by GC, which I think stood for George Carlton. But he was a trumpet player. But he was a dentist by trade, and he used to do all the musicians' teeth in Houston. So like Jimmy Ford was somebody who was always kind of around. We have a lot of old tapes of Jimmy Ford, who's a really Texan alto player. You know, you could maybe find some YouTube videos on him. But he was like kind of a Texas, you know, I guess legend. He's Texan, you know. A big figure in the jazz community back in the day, and him, so that's how music kind of entered the family, because he always dad always said that it was a musical family, and that I was like a sixth generation musician or something, you know. Even though nobody had done it in my trade, everybody had done it in bands. I think my grandfather had a big band back in the day at one point, and my grandmother used to sing in it. So that's a lot of how music entered the household.
Rob, now, did you go to college after that?
After high school, I went to UNO. I went to I went there for just jazz performance. And,
why did you go to UNO?
Because it was the year of 9/11, and I wanted to go to New York, but it was all fucked up up there. You know? Like they usually have people from the schools come and fly down, and no one would fly. Like
right.
Everybody was tightening their budgets. Everybody, it felt like kind of like apocalypto for them. You know, they're in this mode. But regardless of which, I didn't get any scholarship to go up there, and I just couldn't afford it. UNO gave me a free ride, and so that brought me here. In retrospect, it's one of the better things that's happened to me, you know, because I think I could have gotten pretty single-minded if I went up there, and hopefully that hasn't happened to me.
What makes you think you would have become single-minded up there?
Because it's a herd mentality. I've been wanting to mention this for the whole interview, but I just recently read your article on the rehashing of old styles. I forget the name of it, but it's about the, you know, one phrase that stood out from it really was people don't want to be on the losing side, you know. And if that's true for any place, that's definitely New York, you know what I mean? And one of the ways that that's true is, A, that people get the whole focus of their musical approach is on strength, and the other focus of it is being able to stand out, you know? And the other focus is attaching yourself to, like, a tribe. I think it's incredibly tribalistic society, you know.
Yeah.
Now, I think it used to be very individual,
yeah.
And there was room for an individual thing, but now it's like the individualist ethos of New York has transferred itself into like a I don't want to say a status symbol because that doesn't quite address it, but like. You know, it's the ethos that they attach themselves to not be on, to be on the winning side of that, to have the right group of elements, to have the thing that sets you apart and makes you not a loser. You know, like, in terms of the critics. If we're gonna frame it in this in that sentence, which I think that really that. Dives a lot into the core of understanding where we're at right now. Mm-hmm. That people don't want to be on the losing side. So you know, I think what would have happened is I would have gotten into one group of playing musicians, probably that I went to school with. I would attach myself to them, which I've seen everybody that went up there from Houston do, and. Not really break ranks too much, you know. And there's exceptions. It's not universal. Like, there's some real notable exceptions. Like, Robert Glasper is a very notable one. He's very supportive. Very, very warm cat, you know.
It's interesting because I first became aware of Robert Glasper in a very weird way. I saw him perform with David Murray because, well, you know, and I that's peculiar, right?
Like, yeah,
the
right.
The previous that all I had seen was Murray. I've seen Dave Murray a lot, but usually the piano player, well, the guy who was John Hicks back when I used to see him once.
Oh, that's a big difference,
a
yeah.
I saw Robert Glasper, like, dude, well, she's down really great, actually, you know. But I couldn't tell what the relationship, I don't know, was show was great. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, David was amazing. And, you know, it was great hearing the big songs.
Watch out. Yeah, that's a twist, isn't it? Yeah.
But then I became aware of me because I started talking to some younger players who were also in school, guys that are actually more your generation. They were like, oh yeah, Robert Glasper. They were saying Robert Glasper. I said, that's weird. I just saw this guy. But, you know, out of a context that I would have been chasing after, and, you know, not them so much, but it was, you know, it was kind of interesting. So, anyway, I just bring that up.
Yeah, no, and it's odd because, yeah, he's like total down home, you know, he could do anything, you know. And he'll play with anybody, he's a real warm cat, you know. But there's also something around what he's done with his music has become extremely popular. It's an extremely popular sound now. Everybody's kind of trying to do this like hip hop hybrid now, you know, or this people are, you know. He's changed a lot of the ways that music is being made. But yeah, it's I don't think he's related to that tribalistic thing that happened in New York. I don't think he's really related to that, but he's had an interesting ripple effect on what was already there, you know what I mean? Just because he's that kind of cat, he just kind of shines, you know. He's somebody we all looked up to coming up.
Let's talk more about the tribalism in New York and this kind of lack of liberalism or what you perceive. How do you think that came about? How do you think we've ended up there? How does this happen? How did things come have those features after previous?
Maybe survival, you know. Because if you band together and play with a certain group of cats, you get used to playing with those guys. You get a stronger sound, which helps you get gigs, and people give each other gigs. You know what I mean?
Well, that sounds like a positive side.
It's a positive that carries within it, like a Trojan horse. You know, I mean, it's good that guys are forming these. Like you have like sounds that are specific to like a small group of people. And it's like, that's a sound in and of itself, you know. Like, one of my favorite, actually my only favorite out of New York right now is like, the Claudia Quintet. And Chris Speed and John Hollenbeck and that kind of circle, Kung Fu, that kind of circle of guys. And they all went to NEC together and then went to New York. But, then so they have their own sound and it's beautiful. There's like nothing that really intrudes upon it nor homogenizes it, nor, you know, it's like it has room to develop.
When you say it has its own sound, what are the features of their own sound?
It's very through composed, and for one thing, the instrumentation of the Claudia Quintet's interesting. It's clarinet, vibraphone, accordion, bass, and drums. And they have a very kind of through composed sound where they have these kind of long compositions, but there's also a lot of space within the compositions, you know, and they develop themes over a long period within the song, you know. It can oftentimes be a very kind of meditative sound, and you know, it's the kind of thing when you hear it, you're like, oh yeah, that's, you know, that's Chris Speed and maybe even the Yeah No group, which is his thing. And, you know, and you got tons of little pockets of that in New York. But the Trojan horse side of it is that it's like you're strong, there's strength in numbers, you know what I mean? And because there's strength in numbers, it denigrates the quality of an individual to move from scene to scene, you know what I mean? And again, going back to not wanting to be on the losing side, like, you're much stronger in a group. There's a phrase I always constantly come back to. I quote it far too much, and it's by W.B. Du Bois. He said, It's as if nature made men narrow so as to give them force. You know, and going back to fascism, it's a perfect lesson because you have a herd of kind of narrow-minded, strength-concerned, I don't know a way to put it, but you have a disaffected youth who find strength in numbers and create a forceful movement out of a narrow conception of you know, a narrow party line, a narrow, no room for doubt kind of ideology, you know.
So this is what you found from down here when it was going on in New York, and you felt you didn't perceive that in New Orleans?
Not at all. You're starting to see it, you know? Like, especially in the anachronistic scenes that you're alluding to, you know, like you have, you know, like, I don't know if it's purely, I don't think it's the musicians' fault. I think the musicians are more open as they maybe have been.
Oh, yeah, I mentioned, I mean, they could be playing something else. I mean, I'm interested in why they're doing it, because it's, we're talking about a good deal of them have the skill to have made the choice.
They're doing it, I think, because they have to, you know? I mean, clubs have seen this thing, this like single-minded thing, and it's worked for them to have. I don't know if this is gonna piss anybody off, but Trad Band X, Funk Band X, you know, Brass Band X, you know, and that aligns itself to like a group of people that align themselves to it, you know. That's, and plus it's, you know, yeah.
Yeah.
It's like going back to the thing, you don't want to be on the losing side. You better know how to dance, like,
yeah.
And you better look like shit, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you better look like a New York Irish mobster from the 1910s, you know
right.
what I mean?
Right.
And it's like, with a, it's like, you know, unless you want to be on the losing side, and that's only maybe the, you know. There's all kind of layers in New Orleans where you're on the losing side if you do something, you know. Like if I bring an iPad into Flora's Cafe, you know, it's not going to bode well for me, you know. But
I'm glad we did the interview here. Yeah.
Yeah, really.
Although maybe we should go over there and see what happens.
Yeah, do a little anthropological experiment.
Yeah.
You know. But if somebody like them goes to the Starbucks in Lakeview, like, you know, it's like they're screwed, yeah, you know. It's like, and they'll feel that disaffection, you know. Very, they'll thrive in it.
So at UNO, he went in for jazz performance, and who were you taught by there?
I was taught by Ed Peterson. He really taught me how to practice, man. He's just a thorough scientist, man. He's an incredible musician. He's an incredible musician here. That's, I think, sustained a lot of sax players. You know, a lot of guys took from him. Dogate and
what did he teach you about how to practice?
Just the methodology of breaking a sound down, taking a pentatonic sound, doing every possible combination within that sound, doing every possible, you know, harmonic structure that you can plug that sound into and how it plugs in, you know, and just like giving yourself a thoroughness and like, you know, examining the possibilities, you know, and plus, he's just an incredible technician, you know. The other people I took from when I was here with Bryce Winston when he was still more around.
It's like about my 6 months there or whatever.
Yeah, you're right. Y'all were in the same class?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was you and Bryce and
lots of people,
yeah.
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 because the program wasn't together yet. They really had no idea. It's kind of funny.
but it formed the core of a lot was going to happen later, you know?
I don't know what I'm doing. I'm not a big included in most of those guys doing it, but it's funny how what that turned into.
It formed
the picture of what that school was doing.
Well, yeah, you know, I mean, I think that was UNO in the 90s, and that was jazz in the 90s, you know what I mean? It's like, it was in its own state, you know? And
I think jazz, I think also, you know, we're now 22 years on, jazz education has become such a force at that point, it's sort of like, you know, there was some of it going on, but it wasn't like, now it's like a collage, it's like,
oh, yeah.
I'm not even over this whole world of, you know, to see those conventions and that. But,
man, I'm telling you, yeah.
But let me get back. So, Bryce Winston, and what else?
I studied from a classical flute teacher, too. Well, but Bryce was great, because Bryce, like, kind of countered Ed in a lot of ways, in that he was more about, we would just get in a record and just dig that record, you know? Or, like, we would get into, like, an original composition and say, like, well, how are you feeling about it? Where do you want this to go? You know, and in a solo, we would just spend like 20 minutes on like four bars and getting the feeling of that four bars, you know. Bryce is incredibly good at like just getting right into the music, you know. And anyway,
into
I diverge.
The emotional side.
Yeah, into the like the real the content. Of a, which Ed did too, you know. I mean, he could certainly do that, but he's so versed in this other thing, you know.
Well, Bryce always struck me as a guy that's very, he's always been extremely unattractive. Like, you know, he knew right away, and it wasn't an academic attraction that he had to that. He really felt a feeling from it. He didn't talk really to it. For me, you know, I was looking at him.
Oh, yeah, he absolutely would, you know. I mean, we'd play even, like, I'd do the solo, and then, like, instead of doing the solos, we'd spend 5 or 10 minutes digging on this opening brushes sound that, you know, like, I don't know who it would be, maybe Philly Joe or something start off with this brushes thing and just be like, man, listen to that, that's just so killing, like, that, you know. It was really an emotional connection for him, yeah. And you're right, he's always been very, very driven and undistracted. He's